morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Okay. Nevada Court of Appeals is now in session. This is Michael Gibbons speaking for Carson City Judge. In the Las Vegas courtroom, our judge is Jerry Tao and Judge Bonnie Bullock. We're still following the governor's guidelines and directives from the Chief Justice about social distancing and any other protections we might use to safeguard everyone. So we're continuing with oral arguments by video. We're also using masks and social distancing in Carson City. There's myself at the bench. It's a very large bench here. And we have two staff members at opposite ends, and we have one person in the audience. And everybody has the mask on. I just took mine off after I sat down. Judge Tao and Judge Bulla, would you like to do a welcome from Las Vegas?
Good morning. We're glad you were able to join us today via the video conferencing. Please let us know if you have any difficulty at all on our end, and we'll certainly help adjust whatever we need to do to make it a more fruitful experience.
And I just want to echo that. Thank you, everybody. Good morning, and thanks for being flexible. I know we're all kind of muddling our way through this, and this is our second argument day trying to use it this method, and hopefully there won't be any electronic glitches, which, you know, sometimes happen, and we appreciate your accommodating us, and we're looking forward to it. Okay.
All right, we have four cases set for today. The first one is Ricky Slaughter versus the State of Nevada Department of Corrections. This case has been pending for a while. We finally have gotten here to the argument, and this case has a lot of interesting issues, so we're looking forward to hearing from counsel. We have Mr. Shook appearing for Mr. Slaughter. This is part of the pro bono program. Thank you, Mr. Shook, for taking this case on. It's much appreciated.
Of course.
Okay. And Mr. Gilmer from the Attorney General's office is supposed to be here too. I don't see him at the moment. There he is. Can you hear me okay?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Can you hear us okay?
Yes, we can hear you perfectly. I just figured I would pretend it's a courtroom and I'd sit at my chair until it's time for me to come up to the podium, but I can hear everything perfectly. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. Okay, that's your discretion how you want to handle that on your end. We're going to try to avoid interruptions as much as possible because there's a very slight time lag. We did use the same procedure at the end of May. It worked pretty well. Not perfect, but it worked pretty well. Counsel, if you do hear a judge say something, please stop, or if you see somebody raise their hand. But generally speaking, we're going to try and keep the interruptions to a minimum. All right, Mr. Shook, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. Are you able to see the clock?
Yes, it still says 15 at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, we're not cutting you short. All right. You may go
ahead. Okay. Great. Good morning, everyone. I hope all of your families are safe during these times. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Shook, and I represent appellant Mr. Ricky Slaughter. And we are here today to ask the court to reverse and remand the district court's decision, which denied Mr. Slaughter the opportunity to recover from shotgun wounds, which caused him to black out and seek emergency care. Shrapnel from these shots are still lodged in his head, which today, over 6 years after the incident, still give him migraine headaches. We're here today because the district court made an error by granting the defendant's motion to dismiss, and Mr. Slaughter properly pled deliberate indifference, conspiracy to commit deliberate indifference, and tortious negligence against defendants Bean, Nevin, unnamed defendants John Doe 1 and John Doe 2, and he pleaded negligence properly against the state of Nevada. Let's start with the clear-cut issues, which is Joe defendant number 1. This defendant has never been answered by respondents, and in his complaint, Mr. Slaughter wrote that there was an unnamed officer who told Mr. Slaughter and other inmates that you guys might as well fight now and get it over with. Provoking violence is clearly deliberately indifferent and clearly negligent. And this is something that, once again, has never been addressed by defendants in the lower court, nor has it been addressed by respondents in their answering argument.
Well, Mr. Shirk, let me ask you this. There are some Ninth Circuit cases that talk about if it's true that the guards orchestrated a riot or incited a riot in some way, and that riot injures an inmate, that that's a 1983 cause of action. But in this case, you've kind of got this extra causative step here. My understanding of the allegations is that your client is alleging that the inmates, that the guards incited this riot, but Mr. Slaughter wasn't actually injured by the rioting inmates. He was injured by the guard firing a shotgun in what I gather was actually a legally permissible response to a legally permissible method of stopping the riot. And so that's an extra causative step. So how does that fall within the Ninth Circuit cases that we have?
I think it comes down to the question of whether or not the harm was foreseeable. And what Mr. Slaughter pled is that if we're going to corral a bunch of inmates together who some of them were participants in a racially motivated attack prior, you combine them to a small space and you encourage them to fight, that harm and the eventual gunshots used to dispel that fight were foreseeable. There's also another unnamed defendant, John Doe 2, who continued to fire shotgun rounds into a crowd despite Mr. Slaughter lying on his stomach. And we feel that that is, in its very least, negligent, but also deliberately indifferent, because if you see someone on his stomach in a defensive position, you shouldn't be firing shotgun rounds into a crowd. So after talking about John Doe 1, I would like to bring your attention to Defendant Bean, who admitted to Mr. Slaughter that the racial riot 3 days prior happened, and that the whole point of corralling the inmates into the courtyard were to identify who exactly were the violent perpetrators. In paragraph 11 of Mr. Slaughter's complaint, he admitted to Bean, "We knew that this was going to happen. That's why we opened it up. Didn't you see me watching you guys earlier in the unit?" It's important to note that Mr. Bean was talking in the first person plural. It's not just him individually taking these actions. It's him conspiring with many other people, including the people with permission to lift the lockdown, which would be Defendant Nevin, and the unnamed defendants who encourage the inmates to fight. Mr. Slaughter further elaborates that the statement that Bean said was a reference to Bean, Nevin, Doe's 1 and 2, knowledge that lifting the lockdown order after the first racially motivated attack without taking sufficient measures to reduce the high risk of a retaliation fight between the groups of racial prisoners, that a riot would ensue. This admission by Bean revealed beforehand knowledge and intentional orchestration by him and his co-defendants. At this case, the instant case, we're at the stage of motion to dismiss. So it's incumbent upon Mr. Gilmer to prove that there are no set of facts that support Mr. Slaughter's claim for relief. And if you look at the four corners of the pleading and just the pleading at this stage, we strongly feel that he did plead properly the deliberate indifference against the defendant Bean, who admitted to him straight up that we orchestrated a riot to identify violent prisoners, the unnamed John Doe defendant who encouraged the inmates to fight once on the grounds, and he also implicates the defendant who shot birdshot into the crowd despite Mr. Slaughter being on his stomach, and Defendant Nevin, who by defendant's own admission with their employee handbook was the person with the authority to uplift the lockdown. Additionally, we have Mr. Slaughter saying that Bean talked about Bean, Nevin, Doe's 1 and 2, a group of people conspiring to orchestrate this riot. By proving deliberate indifference, we also have a claim for negligence. The standard of care is that prison officials have a duty to exercise reasonable care to avoid foreseeable harm. And this is an easier standard to meet over deliberate indifference because it doesn't require that mens rea component that prison officials have to be aware that the harm existed. Here we can allege that Mr. Slaughter has that there was a foreseeable risk of harm by pitting people against each other without doing the necessary steps beforehand, like shuffling the inmates after the first racially motivated attack. And instead, you take the same people outside, you encourage them to fight. That is negligence on its face. And we believe we should proceed to the fact-finding part of the lower court in order to uncover what exactly happened. Why were the same inmates never shuffled? Why were the same inmates drawn to a courtyard in a confined space and be encouraged to fight? The other claim...
Mr. Shook, let me ask you a question. Was there any evidence that Mr. Slaughter was, in fact, doing anything improper or aggressively acting in the courtyard before the shooting with Buckshot started?
No, there is not. And in his disciplinary hearing, which isn't the issue we're raising up today, the officers did not find him with any weapons on the courtyard, whereas other people on the courtyard had weapons. And the fact that these inmates weren't searched for weapons is another reason why we feel that defendants in this case were negligent and deliberately indifferent, because not only are you going to let these people out to the courtyard, you're not going to check them for weapons despite a racially motivated attack happening a few days prior.
And the shots that were directed, or I guess I want to make sure that's clear, they weren't specifically directed at Mr. Slaughter. They were, in fact, just directed into the crowd.
Correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, the shotguns that were used were like a spray, had a spray effect to them. This is cited in the case Perez versus Nevada, which goes into detail of what those shotgun rounds look like. But basically, if you fire them into the crowd, they spray everywhere and have a lot of collateral damage as a result. The final point we'd like to bring up is the allegations against the city of Nevada. The respondents argued that the city of Nevada shouldn't be responsible for 1983 claims against it. But they failed to recognize in the lower court that Mr. Slaughter pleaded a case of negligence against it. This was something that we brought up in our opening brief and something that was once again conceded by respondents. NRS 41.031 waives liability from the state in lawsuits, and there are some exceptions. The exception pertaining to us would be NRS 41.0332, where a prisoner needs to exhaust all of his administrative remedies. Mr. Slaughter did exactly that, and therefore we should also have a case against the city of Nevada. So, once again, we have a direct admission by defendants that Mr. Slaughter pled, and the standard here today is to look at this case de novo, and it's incumbent upon respondents today to prove that there are no set of facts to support Slaughter's claim of relief. If you draw all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, and you are more lenient toward plaintiff because he was a pro se litigant, no internet access, he's just doing the best he can to write these pleadings down, we see a very direct admission in count one that draws a very clear story that defendants were deliberately indifferent to his harm by orchestrating a riot. There's no reason why you need to take violence in order to identify who were the violent perpetrators. There's also an issue of supervisor liability that we could talk upon. This was an argument that respondents made. The supervisor liability and how they differentiate Starr versus Baca does not take into account a direct admission by Bean. The issue in that case was whether or not the supervisor was on notice. Here, Mr. Bean admitted to Mr. Slaughter that, yes, he was on notice because we knew that this was going to happen. That's why we opened it up. So I think the instant case exceeds the standards established by Starr versus Baca to prove that Mr. Slaughter properly pled deliberate indifference in the instant case. Last, before my time runs out, there's also an issue of conspiracy to commit deliberate indifference. Once again, this is clearly shown by Mr. Bean's use of the word we. It demonstrates that more than one person was involved, and that demonstrates the agreement of minds to violate Mr. Slaughter's constitutional rights.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Shook.
Thank you.
We will turn to the Attorney General's office for Mr. Gilmer.
Good morning, Judge Gibbons, members of the court. My name is Randy Gilmer. I'm here on behalf of the defendants. And while I appreciate Mr. Shook saying it's incumbent upon me to show evidence, it's not incumbent upon me. It's incumbent upon the record and my clients. So I do appreciate that. And it sounds as if here, I believe, based upon both what Mr. Shook argued here as well as in the response to the supplemental notice that was before this court, that we're only at this point dealing with the Eighth Amendment and negligence claims, and that the due process claim is no longer before this court. So unless the court has any questions for that, I'm just going to focus on the excessive force, Eighth Amendment, and negligence issues that were dismissed. And in that respect, I'd like to point out, in response to Judge, I go in reverse order here, Judge Bula had a question pertaining to any record evidence of whether or not Mr. Slaughter was involved in the fight. And I would argue, first off, that while there is some evidence from other cases, I don't believe that in this particular case that that question has been answered based upon the situation of where we were. However, I will point out that there is somewhere in the record that there is also counter response to that, and that caseworker Calderon testified at the disciplinary hearing that she observed Mr. Slaughter in I believe she used the words fighting stance or something along those lines during the riot. So that's obviously a dispute of fact with regard to whether or not Mr. Slaughter was or was not involved in the fight. But again, I think it's important for us to focus on the fact that we're at the motion to dismiss stage here. So we're looking at the four corners of the pleadings. And in that respect, I don't think that that factual question is necessarily relevant to the court's de novo review of these circumstances. But I did think it was important to point out that it's not as clear cut one way or the other as to whether or not Mr. Slaughter was a perpetrator in the fight, and the Nevada Department of Corrections believes that he was. So I just did want to point that out since it sounded like we were talking about some extrajudicial record information. With regard to the actual determination here and the focus that plaintiffs and Mr. Slaughter has put on the shotgun blast, and this also goes to Judge Tao's question pertaining to Ninth Circuit law and the rioting issue, and that if a riot is staged, that could be some 1983 liability. I think it's important to point out again here that we're not talking John Doe number one, John Doe number two. These individuals have never been identified. They've never been served. They are not defendants in this case. So what we're looking at here is whether or not the particularly named defendants and those that were served had any way of knowing and had any way of staging the riot. And in that respect, even though there is the statement in paragraph 11 from Lieutenant Bean, I do not believe that it is clear that what Lieutenant Bean is talking about, even in that instance there, was talking about a riot. And even if it was, because again, we're talking on the face and having to give all the assumptions to plaintiff in that respect, this goes to Judge Tao's question. We're not here because Mr. Slaughter was injured by an inmate in a riot that, according to paragraph 11, Lieutenant Bean orchestrated with unknown John Doe's. We're here because Mr. Slaughter alleges that he was injured while they were breaking up the riot. And in that respect, as Judge Tao pointed out, at this point in time, and yes, Perez versus Nevada does discuss the policy, but at the point in time that this case existed, there had been no case law that said that the buckshot policy used in Nevada at that point in time was unconstitutional or inappropriate use of force to quell a disturbance. So I think in that respect, it's very important, and it takes it outside the context and realm of whether or not Lieutenant Bean and may or may not have orchestrated a riot with these unknown individuals. And again, for the record, just in case I have to make it clear, we obviously highly dispute that any such riot was ever orchestrated by the Department of Corrections. But again, I realize that we have to give facial acceptance to what is pled. So in that respect, that's the only reason why I'm pointing that out.
Mr. Gilmer, let me ask you a question. Do you, under the current state of the law, do you agree or disagree that the simple act of placing the inmates in a potentially dangerous situation is sufficient to demonstrate deliberate indifference? In other words, if they had not been placed in the situation that they were, arguably, nothing, a riot wouldn't have happened. So that is the causation issue that I do think needs to be addressed. So I would like you to address that issue. But also this concept of the fact that this riot did in fact happen and the fact that they were placed in that situation, is that sufficient to demonstrate deliberate indifference?
Thank you, Judge. I think I understand your question, and respectfully, my response to that question is no, it's not enough necessarily to put somebody in harm's way, and that might sound shocking or egregious that I'm saying that, but we're talking about a prison setting. Prisons, by their very nature, are dangerous situations, and if that was the position that we had to be held to, then I would dare say you would never be able to let anybody out of their cell, which obviously is not what any is not good for prisoners, not the policy of the state, and not what anybody would ever want to do. So I don't think that that's enough. I think what needs to be shown is that there is a known harm and that it's reasonably likely that somebody will be injured because of it. And in that respect, I don't believe that the fact that there had been a fight 3 days before and that there potentially even under plaintiff's allegations was that there was going to be another riot when it broke up. These things are known. I mean, these things happen. Prisons have riots. Unfortunately, it's a very dangerous situation. The question is, was the Department of Corrections and its employees ready and prepared to quell any such riot when the decision to reopen was made? And in that respect, Lieutenant Bean, and this was argued and discussed in our briefs both below and here, had no authority to reopen the cell. It's not under his job descriptions as a lieutenant. It's not anything he can do. So the decision to reopen is not anything that Lieutenant Bean was in the decision-making process to make. So even if there was a causation element in that respect, it's undisputed that Lieutenant Bean would not have it in his job duties to decide for himself and take it upon himself to reopen a unit after a violent situation had occurred. I think that answered your question in part, Judge Bola. I think I may have missed a subset of that. So if I did, please remind me and I will respond. But again, I hope that my answer here is not misinterpreted in any way. Obviously, starting a riot, having a riot, that is obviously a circumstance that the Department of Corrections would never do. But I do think that in and of itself, being in an area of harm is not enough to create 1983 liability in that respect. With regard to and that takes me to the negligence component as well. And I think the foreseeability argument the plaintiff's counsel uses is much more important in a tort and a state tort component than in a 1983 component. Because I think in 1983, we're talking about whether or not there was a constitutional violation. I don't think the question is whether or not it's foreseeable that a constitutional violation may occur. The question is whether or not there was a constitutional violation. With regard to the negligence component here, again, I don't think there's any indication that there's sufficient causation between even the one statement that plaintiff alleges in paragraph 11 to show that Lieutenant Bean, Director Zarinda, or Warden Nevin were negligent in the actions that they did here. I think negligence in this component would have been if, when the riot occurred, the Department of Corrections did nothing to stop it. That would be a very unforced, that would be a situation where you could clearly see negligence. But what we have here is that a riot happened and the Department of Corrections did everything they could to quell it as quickly as they could. And that's what happened. And to the extent that people shot, that was a split second decision made by John Doe's, that despite this case being filed in January of 2016, has never been identified. I realize that we were at motion to dismiss stages twice, but that doesn't prevent plaintiff or you know, Mr. Shook from trying to obtain discovery, especially when they're amending, when they were granted leave to amend. That's certainly something that could have been sought, and there's never been any identification as to who those John Doe individuals were that actually made the decision to shoot. So I think that that's very important to look at in the foreseeability component of the negligence claim. Because here, that was the injury that, that Mr. Slaughter complains of, not that he was actually injured in a riot itself, which, again, outside the record, but Mr. Shook claims he was not a part of. So that also suggests that to the, that also undermines the allegation in paragraph 11 that this riot was somehow staged by NDOC when Mr. Slaughter is taking the position that he wasn't involved in any such riot, but yet was in the area where the riot was going to occur. That just on its face seems extremely implausible. Going on to the civil conspiracy components, if, assuming I answered the judge's questions appropriately, I'll move on to the civil conspiracy components very briefly. And that is, to the extent that there is a conspiracy here, I don't believe that that has been shown because, I, as indicated, I do not believe there's been an underlying indication of a constitutional violation. Case law in Nevada is quite clear, and for that matter, I think anywhere in the country, that you cannot conspire to act negligently. And the whole definition of negligence is that it's something that it was a mistake and not something you were going to be doing. So it's very difficult to see how any of the defendants could have conspired to act negligently. They could have conspired to act intentionally, but that's not been an allegation that was brought. There's no intentional torts here that were brought with regard to state law. The only tort under state law that was brought was negligence. And so I think it's clear that under state law, there cannot be on its face a conspiracy to commit negligence. With regard to the 1983 component, It's a similar analogy in the sense that you can have an intentional violation of somebody's constitutional rights, at which point conspiracy could apply. But in the context of a Eighth Amendment excessive force or deliberate indifference claim, there is also some sense of mistake or negligence, if you will, especially here when we extrapolate out to the extent that they claim that the injury to Mr. Slaughter's occurred, and we're not disputing that there was injuries to Mr. Slaughter. Obviously, he was shot with buckshot inadvertently during, while trying to quell it. So we're not disputing that there was an injury, but that injury in and of itself occurred because of an action by an officer making a split-second decision to use buckshot that at the time was legal and had never been found not to be legal. And therefore, there is no indication that there was a meeting of the minds by Nevin Bean or Zarinda to use buckshot in an improper manner to quell a riot, especially since that decision to use the buckshot was made in on the scene by the officer present there. So, again, I don't think you can have a 1983 civil conspiracy claim in this context, in this particular case, based upon what is known from the record. I see that I have 1 minute of time left. However, I am done with my oral argument unless the judges have any last questions for me before I sit down.
So, Mr. Dillimer, one of the differences between Nevada's 12B5 standard and the federal 12B6 standard is that we don't have the standard of plausibility that Iqbal and Twombly created. In fact, the Nevada Supreme Court has, they haven't really expressly rejected it, but they've never adopted it, so we don't have it here. So this may be a claim that might fail under federal law because it's, if you assume the allegations of the complaint all to be true, you've got this long conspiracy that involves a whole bunch of stuff happening just exactly the way the conspirators wanted it to, and it may be implausible, but that's not a standard that we have here. So what gives us a legal ground here under our 12B5 to say, well, this just is so ridiculous that we can't let this go forward?
Judge Tao, I'm sorry, are you referring to the negligence component, the conspiracy component, or both?
The 1983, the civil conspiracy. The allegation here seems to be, yes, they orchestrated a prison riot, and yes, the inmate wasn't hurt by other inmates, but the allegation seems to be they orchestrated this whole riot, knowing it would spiral out of control, and that would give them an opportunity to shoot this guy with a shotgun. And again, you can argue whether or not that's plausible, because it's this sort of ballet-like choreography, but if it's all true, does it at least on its face state a claim under our jurisprudence?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I see my time is up, but I presume you would like an answer to that question.
Yes, please.
I would think that in that respect, as far as the 1983 component goes, while the Nevada Supreme Court may not have been clear as to the Iqbal standard, because we're dealing with a federal claim under 1983, I think that the fact that the Nevada Supreme Court has not weighed in on the Iqbal standards is not necessary for the courts to determine that Iqbal applies, because it is a federal claim, so therefore it's controlled by federal law looking at 1983, not state law in that respect. And I think you were asking specific with regard to 1983, so that's my answer. If you want me to address it with regard to negligence, I will, but I know that my time is up, so I want to make sure I understood the question appropriately before I talk further.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmer. Mr. Shook, you have the full 5 minutes.
All right, so I'd like to start with the issue of what the standard is today. I think the standard pretty clearly is the no set of facts standard. This was the standard argued by defendants in the lower court, and it's also the standard that the Supreme Court held as recently as Zani versus Kern Associates in 2018, stating that this is the standard, not the Twombly-Iqbal standard. Mr. Gilmer claims that all prisons have a risk of harm, and that because there's a risk of harm, there's always a risk of riots. We feel that Mr. Slaughter specifically pled reasons why this situation is uniquely different. I'd like to direct your attention to paragraph 2 of count 1 of his complaint, where he talks about a racially motivated attack happened 3 days prior to when he got hurt. And after that happened, standard procedure at HCSP, this is reading from the complaint, following such incident would have been to shuffle or move certain members of Hispanic and Black prisoners to different units, effectively dispersing, separating prisoners that may have been plotting retaliation from the bad blood flowing from the previous incident, to sweep, shake down, search unit 6A prisoners for weapons in the unit, and to keep the lockdown effect for at least 2 to 3 weeks to allow for a cool-off period between the prisoners in the unit and the complete separation of moving certain key prisoners to other units in the prison. But the mentioned defendants did not do any of this at the time. By stating that the defense's conduct was uniquely an aberration from what they should have done, proves both the substantial risk that a harm would exist and the foreseeability claim under negligence, because by letting this anger ferment and then directing them outside to a courtyard, encouraging them to fight to identify the violent prisoners, we have both deliberate indifference and negligence. With regards to once again, the respondents, Mr. Gilmer, like the respondents, argue that B didn't have the authority to reopen the cell. Once again, I'd like to direct your attention to the fact that Mr. Bean, in his admission, said we. He did not say, I did this, I did that. He says we, to imply that there was more than just him doing these actions. And if Bean didn't have the authority to lift the lockdown, then Defendant Nevin would, as Mr. Slaughter alleged in the preceding paragraph after Bean's admission. Mr. Gilmer talked about whether or not birdshot was an inappropriate use of force. The issue here today is not whether the buckshot in itself was inappropriate, but whether or not the circumstances and the actions that defendants set in motion created an environment where it would be likely that you would spray these buckshot rounds into a crowd, because you're literally inciting prisoners to fight to identify who is violent and who is not. And once again, Mr. Slaughter pled that what the defendants did wasn't standard prison procedure. It didn't uphold their standard of care to keep safe prisons. Prisons are violent enough as it is. We agree with that. But to add an encouragement of violence by correctional officers goes above and beyond what Mr. Slaughter should be entitled to and is a clear violation of his rights. With regards to suing DOE defendants, There is a sister case argument. This would be Castaneda versus Faustin, where you could sue unnamed John Doe prison officials and then eventually figure out who they were through discovery. Please remember that Mr. Slaughter did serve the Nevada Department of Corrections because he did want to find this out. In count two, which is not the issue of today, but Mr. Slaughter in that count wanted to bring up his cellmates to help him identify who this John Doe was. If we have an opportunity to examine this John Doe defendant in the lower court, we would be able to depose his fellow inmates and figure out who these people actually were. There is no case law that says just because John Doe hasn't been served, you can't have a claim against John Doe. There's, in fact, a case that, once again, it's in the sister courts in the East District of California, but it says exactly this, that you can serve the state responsible for it and then eventually figure out who those people were through discovery. So for the aforementioned reasons, we believe Mr. Slaughter has valid claims against the two named defendants, Mr. Bean, Mr. Nevin, and there's also the case of negligence against the state, which Mr. Gilmer didn't answer, and something that we brought up in our appellate argument that NRS 41.031 and 0.0332 still makes the state liable for a tortious negligence claim so long as Mr. Slaughter exhausted his administrative remedies. And that's it. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Does the court have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Gilmer, too. This case, Slaughter versus State, number 74447-COA, will be taken under advisement by the Court of Appeals, and we will issue a written decision in the near future. Again, we want to thank everyone for your patience and waiting so long to get this case to argument. Mr. Shook, especially for taking this through the pro bono program, doing an excellent job. Mr. Gilmer, doing your usual excellent job, too. So it's been very helpful to hear from both of you this morning. Extremely helpful. Judge Tower, Judge Bulla, would you like to make any concluding comments?
Thank you so much for being with us via the video conferencing. Overall, I think it is a very good alternative, although we, of course, would love to have you here in person. But we really appreciate you taking the time, and you were both so very well prepared. Thank you.
Yeah, as always, Mr. Gloom, you've argued in front of us a couple of times, and we've always really enjoyed your level of preparation and your argument. And Mr. Shook, I want to echo the Chief Judge Gibbons' comments. Thank you for taking the case pro bono. One of the issues that we have is, there are more cases than there are lawyers willing to take them, and it's always nice to see an attorney willing to step up on a pro bono basis, especially in an inmate case. Those tend not to be the most, for certain members of the bar, maybe not the most appetizing of cases. So we really appreciate your willingness to get involved in this case.
Of course.
Okay. And we hope you take another one, too.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay, well.
And did either one of you see any problem with the technology that we use today?
No, this was great. I think BlueJeans, I try a lot of video conferencing software at my regular job, so I think this is probably the best one of the batch. I think it's better than Zoom, for what it's worth.
It worked great, Your Honor. This is my third oral argument via video. I've had two by the Ninth Circuit. That was via Zoom, and this as well. They're both set up a little differently. We've not had any issues with either, so echoing Judge Bulla's comments, I think that this is the best we can do under the circumstances, but it will be nice to be back in person someday arguing before you guys again. So, thank you.
Okay. All right, well, thank you to both of you.
All right, thank you again. We'll be in recess till 11.